Today's January 20th, we're learning Shmuel. First thing I want to do is answer the question, why does this book exist in the first place? Shmuel was the last of the Shoftim. Shaul and David were the first of the Malachim. So the stories about Shmuel could have been at the end of Sefer Shoftim. Shaul and David should have been part of Sefer Malachim. Right? What makes Shmuel, one of the Shoftim, so zoche to have his own book? And the fact is that the entire book has 55 chapters, right? 31 in Shmuel Aleph, 24 in Shmuel Bet. And he dies well before the halfway point of those two books. Right? There's a whole book, Shmuel Bet, where he's not even there. Just parenthetically, the idea of dividing this semester's book into two is not a Jewish idea at all. There's no such thing in any Gemara, any Maimar or Chazal. Christians divide Shmuel into two, and Malachim into two, and Divrei Hayamim into two. It became convenient. There's another more profound thing the Christians did that became convenient for us, is to divide the Tanakh into chapters. Right? That I just told you 31 chapters? It's not a Jewish thing. Shmuel, Shmuel. We have something called Parshiot. Right? Not to be confused with this week's Parsha B'Shalach. Really, the correct word to describe what we're going to read in Shabbos is this week's Sidra. Parsha is a different thing. Right? But anyway, I just want to point that out. Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet is very nicely divided between Shaul, who dies at the very end of Shmuel Aleph, and David, who takes over at the beginning of Shmuel Bet. So that's a convenient delineation, but it's not a Jewish one. Yes?
So if the Christians are the ones that divided Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet, and get so forgiven, why do we still use it?
So I just thought of convenience. It was convenient. Only one book of Tanakh has Prokim and Chazal. Because this book has natural beginnings and endings, except for three of them. And there are opinions within Chazal, but those three actually mesh with the Prokim right before. And we will be analyzing this book as an adjunct to Sefer Shmuel. We'll be doing it often. Of course, I'm referring to Tehillim. Yeah. Right? There will be things within Sefer Shmuel that will have light shed upon them by Prakim and Tehillim. Some of them are contradictory, and we'll see how to resolve those apparent contradictions. And there is even going to be a third book besides Shmuel and Tehillim that we will be analyzing this semester, but much more in Shmuel Bet than in Shmuel Aleph. That is Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim l'Malchei Yisrael in Malchei Yehuda has very little of Shaul's life, which means it doesn't interact much with Shmuel Aleph, but it does interact very much with Shmuel Bet. Okay, so halfway through the semester, we start Shmuel Bet. We will look at Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim just begins with the death of Shaul, as far as the discussion of the kings. The first nine chapters of Divrei Hayamim starts with Adam Arishon. The first word in Divrei Hayamim is Adam. Goes through the history of the world and Klal Yisrael until, gives you a lot of lists of names mostly, until Shaul. Tells the death of Shaul in chapter 9 and 10, and then chapter 11 to the rest. It talks about mostly David Shlomo, and then quickly the rest of the kings. Okay, so there's not much we will do in Shmuel Aleph with respect to Divrei, but plenty in Shmuel Bet. Now, to answer the question, why does this book even exist? So, it is really simply a testament to the greatness of Shmuel. You might not have been exposed to such a mahalach, but we all know, and it's considered a tenet of faith to the Rambam, that no Nabi has approached Moshe's Nevuah. Familiar with that? Come be Israel, come Moshe Od, Navi Mavid, Esther, so. Right? No Navi has approached the greatness of Moshe. There are scholars who suggest that the reason why the Rambam considered that to be a tenet of faith, in other words, if you don't believe it, you are a heretic. Right? The Rambam made 13 principles of faith. Others after him felt that's too many. Just keep, you know, reward and punishment, the Torah from Sinai, just keep a few. But the Rambam, if I say, I know Yeshayahu very well, and I just think Yeshayahu was greater than Moshe. Right? That makes you a heretic, according to the Rambam. But there are some scholars who suggest that it was really a response to Christianity, who felt that one person eclipsed Moshe, and Islam, who felt another person eclipsed Moshe. So let it be known that, no, that's heresy to think so. No one can eclipse Moshe when it comes to the prophetic vision. Okay, so fair enough. We believe that, fine. Who's second? So is everybody else second? Right? So I'll just tell you, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but there's a parish of Abravanel. Abravanel, that's the proper pronouncement of his name. It's his parish to his introduction to Sefer Yirmiyahu, where he says that Moshe is first, and there's no purpose to explaining who comes after Moshe. All of the Nevi'im are at one level, and Moshe is on the other level. However, I will tell you that there are three separate Ma'amarei Chazal that darshan a pasuk in Sefer Devarim, where Hashem tells Moshe twice, "I will one day appoint a navi like you over Israel." Parsha Shoftim. "I will one day appoint a navi like you over Israel." Any thoughts who that might be? Okay, she was one of them. Who else? I would have thought Yehoshua. After all, Yehoshua is his direct following. He takes over right after him. Right? But it's not. Yehoshua does not get there. But Shmuel is one. Who else?
Yirmiyahu
is another. That is not a nubby, no. He's not because you're right still. But who else? No, this is a tough one. Ezra is so far. Okay. It's an interesting drash in itself why Eliyahu is not included, because Eliyahu does things that just very much like Moshe. He spends 40 days and 40 nights without eating on a mountain like Moshe. That should make you like Moshe, no? But anyway, that's a separate drash why Eliyahu is not included, but I'll table that for the moment. Yirmiyahu is considered one just like Moshe. They both gave Nevuah for 40 years. They both gave Tochacha. Ezra Bitaras Moshe. The second paragraph in Sanhedrin gives a whole list of comparisons between Ezra and Moshe. But Chazal admit that a little different than Abravanel. See, Abravanel says Moshe, everybody else. Right? The two psukim I'd like to suggest to you that show that it's Moshe, Shmuel, and everybody else. And that's why we have this book separately from Shoftim and Malach. It's Moshe, Shmuel, and everybody else. Okay, so listen to these two psukim. And for this reason I tell you, you will need for this class, guys, there's a Sfarim sale going on soon. Sefer Shmuel Mikros Gedolos. Not Sansino, not Das Mikra, Mikros Gedolos. Got it? Preferably with Malbim, but if not, we're okay. Alright? And a full Tanakh. Okay? Got it? So, if you were opening up a full Tanakh to Yirmiyahu chapter 15, verse 1, Perek Tesvav Pasuk Aleph, and Yirmiyahu, listen to what Hashem tells him. Yirmiyahu had been begging God to be more forgiving upon Israel and to go easy on them. Right? Listen to what Hashem tells Yirmiyahu. Vimmer Shem Eli. Im Ya'amod Moshe Ushmuel Fanai. Ein Nafshia Ba'om Hazeh. Even if you would get Moshe and Shmuel to pray for them, I wouldn't listen. So I'm certainly not going to listen to you, right? I mean, Yirmiyahu was one of those guys like Moshe in the Gemara, right? So this pasuk is clear. You know, Shmuel is hundreds of years before this. Surely there was someone else Yirmiyahu could, Hashem could have told Yirmiyahu, you know, to come forward. All right, Moshe, I understand. Moshe is a big praise a lot for Bnei Israel. He gets God to change his mind by the Egel. He gets God to change his mind by the Meraglim, or to lighten up a little on them. So we'll see the Sefer of Shmuel later in this Sefer. He's a great praise for Bnei Israel. So Hashem tells you, oh, even if Moshe and Shmuel would get up here, he didn't say Yeshayahu, he didn't say Eliyahu, he didn't say half of Treyas or that already had given prophecy. Most of the Nevi'im are in the past already by the time of Yirmiyahu. So that's one sign many years later of Shmuel being on a plane by himself.
But he said he wouldn't ease up on them even if they asked.
Even if Moshe and Shmuel, why bring Moshe and Shmuel into
right.
the Okay? But there's another pasuk that's even better than this. But in that pasuk, you know. Because we say it in our liturgy. It's a pasuk that enters our prayers. Moshe Aaron. Moshe Aaron b'kohanav, Shmuel b'korei shemo. Korim al Hashem, v'hu ya'aneh. Now you see why Shmuel is in there. I'm wondering why Yirmiyahu didn't mention Aaron. Right? There is a list of 48 Nevi'im in Maseches Megillah. Megillah Daf Yud Aleph lists 48 Nevi'im. I shouldn't say the Gemara. Is it Rashi, Rabbeinu Chananel, and the Vilna Gaon? The gloss of the Vilna Gaon on Megillah Daf Yud Aleph have their own list of 48 Nevi'im. Who are those 48 Nevi'im? The lists are different. If you add up all of them from all three lists, it gets to be something like 60, 65, something like that. Right? Some count Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov as Nevi'im, some don't. Right? Not all count Aharon as one of the 48 Nevi'im. They all count Miriam as one of the 7 Nevi'ot, because the 7 Nevi'ot are actually listed by the Gemara. Right? Sarah, Abigail, let's say this one in order. Sarah, Miriam, Devorah, Abigail, Hannah, Esther, Huldah. Okay? Was the 7 Nevi'ot. So Moshe v'Aharon b'Kohanav, u'Shmuel b'Korei Shemo, Korim el Hashem v'Hu Ya'aneh. Notice that Shmuel on one side, Moshe and Aaron on the other side. Let me explain why that is. Okay, this, according to Chazal, has to do with something that Moshe complained about at the burning bush. Hashem appears to Moshe at the burning bush and tells him, "You have to go perform this mission," and Moshe keeps pushing it off. Right? According to Rashi, Rashi quotes Shmos Rabbah in the Gemara that says that Moshe was worried about his older brother. Right? Who would feel, who's this younger brother coming in to take over? You know, where's he been all this time? You know, he's living in the palace. One day he comes out and sees how his brother is suffering, and he escapes to Midian. He's been away all this time. Who is he to take to get all this gedula? So Moshe said, God, I don't deserve this. It's a beautiful antidote, if you will, to say for Bereishis, where younger brothers, you get the point, are always eclipsing older brothers, right? The older brother doesn't take kindly to it so well, or brothers, and here the younger brother does not want the gedula. Does not want the favoritism, right? He wants the favoritism to go to his older brother. So of course it's not in the text itself. He says shlach nabi atishlach, which means God, surely you have other messengers besides me that you have already sent on a message. Right? We will learn from a pasuk in the beginning of Shmuel Aleph that Hashem spoke to Aaron before he spoke to Moshe. How do you know from just the simple storyline of Sefer Shmos? Because Hashem tells Moshe, your brother is already on his way to meet you. Which means, And you see, Aaron was told before Moshe about the mission. Right? And he is also an antidote. He's the older brother who's not behaving like Esav. He's not behaving like Ishmael. He's not behaving like Yosef's older brothers. He's happy for you. So it's beautiful. You don't want to slight him. He's happy for you. Great. Sefer Bereishis. I can say that Sefer Bereishis has already been somewhat fixed by Ephraim and Menashe. And Menashe gets eclipsed by Ephraim, and you see only Yosef complains. I don't see Ephraim. I don't see Menashe. Right? Okay, so you get the point of what's happening here. So why is Moshe and Aaron placed in one hand and Shmuel on the other hand? So I would say the following. Hashem tells Moshe, you know, Moshe, I originally thought, Hashem is talking to man like a man, but I, you know, that you would be the sole leader doing this. But from your objections, I see you need Aaron. You need a brother with you. Right? Now, allow me to, I take this to a slightly different direction, but I'm doing it because it's important to see what profound role Shmuel played in our history. There are two different leaders that are embodied by Moshe and Aaron. You ever hear that Moshe represents Emes and Aaron represents Shalom, the Kohen, Yosef Lecha Shalom, Moshe Emes, Visaroso Emes? Have you heard of that? Like, I think even in some of the Sfarim that have a picture of Moshe and Aaron in the front, it has one with Emes, one with Shalom. No, not in here. In some of the Gemaras, they have like a picture of Aaron and Moshe in the front cover. Some Gemaras have it. If you ever see Aaron holding up. His hands are out like this, Moshe is holding the Torah, and on one side it says Emes, one side it says Shalom. So Emes is something that is cannot yield. 3 + 2 is always 5, and that's Emes. You can't bend and be flexible over Emes. Right? When Aaron saw the Egel, you know, he was maybe he vacillated, he was hoping to, you know, let me, they killed Chur, if they killed me, it'll be worse for them, so let me give in to them. Maybe by the time they give all that gold and silver to me, Moshe will come down. Right? Moshe would stand there and say, oh, my dead body, you're not doing this. Right? Maybe that's what Chur said. Are you familiar that they killed someone else, they killed another leader? Right? Because twice in Shmos, once in Parshas Bishalach, once in Parshas Mishpatim, Moshe said, Chur is in charge together with Aaron. If you have any questions, you ask Chur. And then after those two parshas, you never hear from him again. So when I go up to the mountain, Chur is in charge. Who's this guy? I never heard of him. I never see him again. So someone that Moshe puts in charge, because they killed him. That's how Chazal derived that they killed Chur. Because he wasn't allowed to see him anymore. Right? So when Aaron saw that they killed Chur, if they kill me too, obviously I don't want to die, but you know, if they kill me too, it'd be worse for them without any leadership at all. So it's fascinating because, let me think of this, until the Egel, who were the ones who were supposed to serve God in the Avodah? Mm-hmm. What? No. The Bechor, right? Kadesh Likol Bechor. Shortly afterwards, about a few months later, it changed from the Kedusha of the Bechor to the Levi, right? Why? Because the Levi didn't worship the Egel. So the one who makes the Egel is in charge of all those Levim? How does that work? Aaron should have been disqualified more than anyone. And he's the one who's not only involved in the Mishkan, he's the one leading the Mishkan with his two sons. At that time, he still had four, but, right, it doesn't make sense. The answer is because the shalom, like we say, Oseh Shalom b'Bramah, we Oseh Shalom Aleinu, right? We shalom has to not be flexible, right? So we call Aaron a spiritual leader of Klal Yisrael. The spiritual leader wears this pompous. I call it that because it's for the glory of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not for Aaron's pomp. But it's for the glory of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. His garments know, in Kohanim, you ever see it, what the Torah says about what the Kohanim do in the Mishkan? Any slight deviation from the protocol of this spirituality is Chayamisa. Right? Because he's not wearing all the garments, he didn't wash his hands, he didn't wash his feet, his hair is too long, or he's mourning, or so you have to be very careful, because the spirituality...
That's usually kind of more MS, though.
Yeah, I hear where that's going, but I would say that the reason for that is because the pagan temples were places of extreme behavior, or the Zoroastrian, you're right, because they kill people, they kill children. So if you stick to a direct protocol, it's not going to devolve into that.
Right.
So here is the reason why Moshe needs an Aharon, not just as a spokesman, but because Emes needs someone else to be shown. Emes can't turn. I can give you a whole shiur on this, but Emes needs a separate shalom. Right? So I would call Moshe the religious leader of Israel. You hear it? And Aaron the spiritual leader of Israel. I'm not sure if it's proper to call the rabbi the spiritual leader of the shalom. Rabbi is much more than that. Right? Rav Soloveitchik compared it to two models of Jewish observance. He called one a mathematical model. Remember what I just told you about Emes? Mathematical model. One was the aesthetic model. The mathematical model is the brisker Talmud with the Seder who's measuring out the matzah, and he's make sure it's a kezias, and he's very careful with all the shiurim, and he's making sure that the tzitzis is long enough, and he's making sure that, you know, they're shiurim, basically, you know, right? The aesthetic model is, what's this mitzvah doing to me? How is it affecting me? I'm afraid today, with all these, today's world, we're so interested in the aesthetic model that we're forgetting the rules, the basic religious obligations. Everything is just how you feel. So then, spirituality is how you feel. Religious is how you're doing it. So Moshe needs an Aaron. Moshe Aaron v'Kohanov, because Moshe is also a Kohen. And Moshe served as a Kohen, remembering Pasha Shmini, to prepare Aaron for his initiation. So Shmuel v'Korei Shmo, because Shmuel, there was a particular reason for this. Shmuel did not have a Kohen logo on his day. Right? You familiar? Why not? Well, something we're about to read today. We're going to get into it today. We're about to open up the sefer. Shmuel did not have a kohen. What happened to the kahuna in the beginning of his day?
His name was Eli?
Yeah, Eli was killed. His two sons were killed. Shmuel became the leader.
Because he was there in the beginning.
Yeah, his youth. But when he becomes the leader, he's a lady. Shmuel's a lady, not a kohen. But Shmuel's a direct descendant of Korach. We'll find in Divrei Yom. And the role played by Moshe and Aaron separately. This is the pasuk until again. Moshe Aaron v'chonav, Shmuel v'korei Shmo. Moshe and Aaron separately. Shmuel had to do himself. And by the way, also the parshas B'shalach, when a mole comes upon us, what does Moshe do? What does Hashem tell Moshe to do? To quell his hands. But what did, before he does that, he says, "Get Yehoshua, get the army, and look together." Why not Moshe? Because the Nitziv says, "Lo hayom b'tiv Moshe la'asot milchama." Right? He was very zealous for any one of them who was beaten, and he punched a guy, and Chazal might have wondered, how could someone who's just living in the palace punch someone to death just like that? A trained guard who's whipping soldiers with a whip in his hand, Moshe can just give him a punch? Right? You kill him? Chazal was so bothered by that question that they said, "Oh, he killed him with Shem Hashem. He killed him with a brick. He killed him." All right, whatever it is. But Moshe was zealous for them, and maybe was a powerful person, right? But he's not a man of war. Listen to what with him. He says, "Yoshua, Okay, Yoshua later would be a great man of war. There's a bust of Sefer Yoshua right in front of West Point, upstate. I've seen it. This is the greatest military leader of all time. Right? So Moshe sends Yoshua as a military leader, because I'm not a military leader. Why am I mentioning this to you? Shmuel is the military leader also. He leads them in battle. For goodness sakes, Shmuel is Moshe, he is Aaron, and he's Yahshua. And you know what? He's also the diplomatic leader. He's a political leader. Chazal say that Moshe was had a din of melech. You ever hear of this? That Moshe was also like a political leader. Of course, he goes to Paro, talks to Paro, it's politics. Talking to a king, you're a politician. Right? But Shmuel acted as look up Shmuel is Moshe, Aaron, Yoshua, and Shaul. There's been no leader in our history who has covered this kind of ground. And all of what I just told you leads us in the first seven chapters. Okay? As our introduction, because the fact is that our first topic is encapsulates the first seven chapters. Actually, you see, we've only been doing 12 things the whole year. You know, we're 1 week might encapsulate a whole bunch of chapters. All right, the second Indian is the She'ilat Melech, the quest of a king, which is chapter 8. But you see, by the time they ask for a king, and Shmuel is very upset with the request. Now you have a hope, you're beginning to feel, why is he upset with Bnei Israel wanting to fulfill one of the mitzvahs of the Torah? Does the Torah come in to appoint the king? It's one of the mitzvahs of the Torah.
What's
he's doing
that?
Right, so... And by the way, this is not the first time in our history where someone asked someone to be king. Gideon was also asked to be king. And also chapter 8 of Sefer Shoftim, and this is chapter 8 of Sefer Shmuel, where Gideon is asked to be king, and he politely refuses, saying, I'm not your king, my son won't be your king, God is your king. He also got it wrong. What do you mean God is your king? There's a pasuk in the Torah. Ki tavo al ha'aretz asher Hashem elokeinu nosein lecha v'amarta v'yishabta v'rishta v'amarta v'shim alei melech v'chol ovim asher tzimtzasai samta v'shim alecha melech asher Hashem elokeinu nosein lecha. In fact, in light of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which I'm not saying Shmuel has to necessarily agree with, because there are two different opinions in the Gemara, but the opinion that is accepted by the Rambam seems to be the maskona of the Gemara, is that you can't destroy Amalek or build the base of Mikdash unless you have a king. Which explains, of course, why we waited 400, almost 500 years after we got into Israel to even think of building the base of Mikdash. Why didn't any of the Shoftim want to build the base of Mikdash? And why did it wait until Shaul for God to command the eradication of Amalek? It should have been done by Yoshua already. You following? Ella, like the Gemara must have determined, yeah, that the king is necessary to fulfill those two mitzvahs. So if you can only fulfill those two mitzvahs if you have a king, why would anyone be upset with the request of having a king? That's topic number two. We'll discuss that when we get up to it. Okay. So that's my introduction.
Using the kings, the fact that kings came about, did that go to the decline of the Levium or no? Where did that cause like a more? Like,
so I'll tell you this: the until Sefer Yeshayahu, but there's probably Hosea is before Yeshayahu. Until that generation of Hizkiyahu's time, Achaz, Yotam, whenever you see a Navi on the scene, it's largely to talk to a king.
Right.
And you know, we don't see Achiyah Shilomi talks to king, Eliyahu's to king. We don't see Naviim getting up on crates giving messages for the masses, for the people on the streets. Right? We don't see them giving that's why Shmuel is mostly narrative. Yeshayahu is a collection of servants. Okay. So I would just say that with the appointment of a melech after all these years, I'll tell you, when we get up to chapter 8, I'll tell you that there are different opinions in the Rishonim of what role the Shoftim played. We have all these Shoftim. Right? The Bravanel, for instance, thinks that the Shoftim were had a din of Melech. I think he's very wrong about... He knows any argument I might have for why I think he's wrong, and I think the answers he gives to those arguments are weak. Do you want to just tell you very quickly? The last pasuk in Sefer Shoftim is, Bayamim ha'heim ein melech b'Yisrael. Ishe yashor ba'atov ve'enov yaseh. The pasuk like that appears three times in Sefer Shoftim. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did whatever they pleased to explain those crazy stories that appear at the end of Sefer Shoftim. Right? So how can you say that the Shoftim is a melech? You know the answer that Ravanel gives? It's a very clever answer. But because of his own political theories being in the court of the King of Portugal and then in the court of the King of Spain, and it didn't help him any, because the position still led to the expulsion. But it's quite obvious if it says in the days of the Shoftim there was no Melech, then the Shoftim is not a Melech. Ein Melech be Israel. So he says, what's the pshat? Who was the last Shoftim in Sefer Shoftim? Shimshon. Where was he? In Israel. He was living amongst the Plishtim. You get it? Vayimim ha'ein, ein melech b'Yisrael. The melech was staying with the Plishtim, doing whatever he was doing there. Tohanam eis Hashem, that he should love the Philistine women and cause havoc amongst them in so doing. So it's very clever, but I don't know. Is that, can you get... Are you accepting such a perush? Vayimim ha'ein, ein melech b'Yisrael. Melech didn't live in Israel. Ishe yashor ve'enov yaseh. That's do you agree? Is that possible? If you politically feel that any leader of Israel had a din of melech, Yeshua was a melech. Now, to be perfectly fair, the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim has a similar mahalach. He says Yeshua was a melech. He says Moshe was a melech. Right? But I would go along. In what way, if you know enough about Sefer Shoftim, would you say that Moshe and Yeshua are in one level and the Shoftim were not on that level? Because the Shoftim, and this is an important point of how Shmuel differentiates itself. The Shoftim, and I will ask you to remember what I'm about to tell you when we talk about Shaul's emergence. The Shoftim did not rule over all, did not judge all of Israel. Right? There's a Maamar Chazal, which Ravanel does agree with, that there were 13 Shoftim over 13 different tribes, later being one of them. He goes to great lengths to prove this. But each tribe got one Shoftim. Right?
At the same time? Or?
No, all the 13 Shoftim traverse close to 500 years. There is a problem with the timeline in Sefer Shoftim. How we resolve that timeline is something that's... When we get up to a pasuk in Perek Yud Gimel, and that's where Radak and Rashi will give a timeline about how many years were between Yitzias Mitzrayim and Sefer Shmuel. Okay, But we see that throughout Sefer Shoftim, the Shofet does not hold sway over anyone outside of his tribe. How do I know? Because I see that when they call other tribes besides their own to battle, they have problems getting that tribe to battle. Gidon, even probably the most successful of our Shoftim, almost went to battle against Shevet Ephraim. Yiftach went to battle against Shevet Ephraim and killed 42,000. And Yiftach is from Shevet Yiftach Gileadi from Shevet Menashe, and he killed 42,000 Ephraim. Those are brothers. 42,000. Devorah and Shiras Devorah. This coming Shabbos is Haftorah. Look carefully at it. Devorah complains. No, sorry. Next Shabbos. This parsha is both. Next Shabbos is Haftorah. Devorah complains about all the Shvatim that she couldn't get to help fight against Yavin Melech Hatzor. Shimshon was handed sent in by the Shevet Yehuda as a troublemaker against the Philistines. They captured him. He didn't want to fight Jews, so he let himself be captured, and then they gave him over to the Philistines. That's where he killed 1,000 of them with the
pillars.
Right?
What? With the pillars?
No, that's the end. Yeah. That's the end of the story.
Killed himself.
So we see throughout Sefer Shoftim that the Shoftim did not hold sway over other tribes, as opposed to Shaul, when the first act as king was to save, and we'll talk about the irony of this when we get up to that story. The first act as king was to confront the following circumstance. The people of Ammon went to a particular city. It just doesn't make sense unless you can see how everything fits in Sefer Shmuel. It's amazing. Go to a particular city. If you look at a map, here's Ammon, and here's the city they went to. All the way, Ammon is in the middle of Yam HaMelech, all the way even to the north of Yam HaMelech. There's a city called Yavesh Gilad. Yavesh Gilad. If you know your Sefer Shoftim, it shows up in your Sefer Shoftim. Yavesh Gilad, the men of this city were threatened as follows. We want a sign of your submission to us. I'm answering a trivia question. You have to mutilate yourselves in a particular way as a sign of submission, and otherwise we will kill all of you. What was that sign? All men must remove their right eye. If we come to town and see the men have both eyes, we will come and destroy you. Okay, so that is the first thing that Shaul is confronted with. Why would they do this to the people of Yavesh Gilad? So I'll tell you later when we get up. Let me give you. At the end of Sefer Shoftim, there are some outrageous, outrageous stories that appear because there's no king in Israel. According to Rabbi Avinel, because the king Shimshon is out busy, Shoftim, no leadership. So how things can devolve if there's no fear of the Malchus, right? And according to the simple pshat, the Shoftim didn't act as Melech. So there's no Melech in Israel, so everyone did whatever they pleased. So there's some really, you have to see the stories inside, starting with chapter 19, 20, 21, and 22. Starting chapter 18. So, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. Five chapters at the end of the show. And the last story is about a man who's traveling with his concubine. And he ends up, after a long story, he ends up in the land of Binyamin. Just like Yerushalayim, a little to the north, right? He ends up in the land of Binyamin. And amazingly, they pull up like a storm story on this guy. He goes to a man's house for lodgings, and they surround the house with everybody from the town, and they say, we want that man, we want to have our sport with him. And the guy says, listen, I'll throw out my concubine, do whatever you want with her, but don't harm her. You know, we came, the other one should have threatened this guy. I came as a guest. And in this story, you see there are no angels. So in the story in Sodom and Bereishis Perek Yutes, Lot is saved, and the angels, smite them with blindness. You know the story, right? Parshas Vayera. With me? So in this story, there are no angels. They take their concubine, and she's screaming all night as they ravage her the whole night. And in the morning,
these are the people of Binyamin?
People of Binyamin. In the morning, when he opens the door, he sees that the concubine is sprawled on the front porch. And he takes her and he cuts her into 12 pieces. And he sends one piece to each tribe, including Levi. And he says that this is, look what the people of Binyamin do to guests who come. They threatened us, and they look what ostensibly they killed her. I can't believe he killed her.
He
was already dead. She was already dead. So the other tribes went to war against Binyamin. Pinchas was involved. They asked the Urim and Thummim. It's a crazy story. And they started to wipe out Shevet Binyamin until only 400 men were left. And the people made an oath that we will never give our daughters to Shevet Binyamin. And then after the oath, they regretted it. They said, oh my goodness, that's it. They know that a whole Shevet of Yisrael will die out. These 400 men, there's no one to marry. Right? Question?
Who cut off the woman?
The concubine is her husband. Maybe we'll call him. So they decided that we regret this. We're wiping out a whole Shevet B'Yisrael. Right? The story is at the end of Sefer Shoftim. Some Mefarshim claim that the actual story took place at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, because Pinchas is in the story. You with me? Pinchas would have to be about 600 years old if this is at the end of Sefer Shoftim. All right. That's probably why Chazal say that Pinchas and Leo were actually the same person. Because if he could be 600, he could also be 800. Right? Alright, anyway. So some say that the story actually took place historically at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. It was just put at the end of Sefer Shoftim to show how bad things can get if you go to the Melech. Alright, anyway, well, we'll put that aside for a moment. They took 400 women from a particular city in Israel and told them to put on white dresses and dance in the field, and these 400 men, I'm not telling you men, this is what's written in Sefer Shoftim, we're at the end of time, this says that this was on Tu B'Av. That's why we do this on Tu B'Av, to replicate this story. One of the things that happened on Tu B'Av, we're at the end of Bava Basra, talks about a whole bunch of things that take place on Tu B'Av. So some of which have to do with Shidduchim, some of the feelings of those things. So the 400 men didn't violate the oath, because we said we wouldn't give our daughters over to them. But we didn't say we wouldn't let them choose the daughters. So they chapped. They said, each one of you take one woman, and this way the tribe of Binyamin will survive. Right? The name of that city where these 400 women came from was Yabesh Gilead. Now, the first king of Israel was from which tribe? Binyamin. Right? So there's no doubt that king is descended from these people. This is where he's from. Right? So now I know what Amon, if they wanted to threaten someone in Israel, let's test the first king and see if he can gather the people. We know about these 12 tribes. They got it. Not even. Binyamin is a tiny tribe. He's not going to get his own tribe to fight against us. Right? They were testing the first king with this bright eye situation. You got me? So let's do what Shaul does. If you know the story, it's just amazing. What does Shaul do to make sure that he got everyone from every tribe to join the fight? Now you see why a king is different than a shofet. He took an ox, he cut it up into 12 pieces. He sent one piece to each tribe in Israel and said, this is what I'm going to do to all of your animals if you don't come out in great numbers to help the people of Yabesh Gilead against the Ammonites. 360,000 people showed up. And the Ammonites were overcome and amazed how this new king could get all these people to show up. You get it? See how the kapara for something cut up into 12? Something cut up into 12? Yabesh Gilead, Yabesh Gilead. You see what's going on? Shofet, the melech cuts up something into 12 to make a kapara. And the melech, Shevet Binyamin, of all places. Right? So he unites the people. Right? The thing cut up into 12. The thing that was cut up into 12 was a sign of how fractious we had become by the time of Sefer Shoftim, right? Shaul cuts up something into 12 as a sign of unity. got it?
Yes.
Wait, a guy, the king, Shaul from Binyamin, goes to Rome.
He cuts up something, the ox into 12.
And he gets him to fight his own
fight
shaman.
Fight as one, yeah.
But to fight up against his own shaman?
No.
To fight to two.
No.
I thought to
fight to save the people, that they won't have to remove their right eye. I'm not gonna, you know what? We'll take the fight.
I thought the people in the Shikilad are all...
They're being threatened by Ammonites. If you don't remove your right eye, we'll come and kill all of you. So Shaul, so they said, you can either remove the eye as a sign of submission, and we'll leave you alone.
The people of Ammon are from the Shia, and they're just Ammon.
Ammon.
They're just Ammon.
Yes.
The Ishkelad was part of the Ammon?
Yes.
Wait.
Yeah, they sent the women, no?
What?
Did they send the women? The Ishkelad?
By this time, the people in Yav Ishkelad, Mistama, are... I'm just part of the story is that that there are not too many men left in Yav Ishkelad. I'm not going to get into why, but there's a battle of men with just women left. Yes?
Wait, then how are their fortune Binyaminites left?
Well, in the battle, it says in the Tanakh, they killed all the men of Binyamin except 400.
Who killed? Ammon killed?
The Jewish people.
Remember when they cut that woman into 12 pieces and they said, how could such a terrible thing happen? We just talked about this 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So the other tribes went to war with that. Pinchas led them and they touched the Urban Tournament.
Oh,
they
asked God, sir.
Should I fight against Binyamin, my brother? He goes, yes, you have to uproot this evil. And they fought against him and swore not to give their daughters over to anyone from Binyamin. But they said, all right, we swore not to give over our daughters. We didn't swear that we wouldn't let them take our daughters. Well, again, okay. So that is. But you see how these events are coming like a kapora to fix the problems of Sefer Shoftim. Right? You see it? Okay, but before we get to that, which is I really went ahead for you, is we have an introduction of Shmuel. Okay, in the beginning of the Sefer. The leadership is in the hands of the Kohen Gadol. His name is Eli. I just had the mayor of Eli in my office yesterday. There's a city called Eli in Israel. It's a huge, sprawling city. It's huge. And it's right opposite Shiloh, which was the religious capital of Israel at the time. Shiloh held a Mishkan for 369 years. Almost as long as the Beis Hamikdash. Long time. Right? The city is named after Eli HaKohen. Vayiach ish echad min ha'Marasayim. It's okay, let's read. Reading in... I don't see if people have this paper here. Okay. I'll make sure to get a Shmuel in the next class. Right? You'll find the misstep, etc. So, the beginning of Shmuel gives this man's background. Right? It starts off with the parents of Shmuel. This additionally shows how chashuv he is. I am told the origins of very few people in Tanakh. Very few. Moshe, the Yelchish Mibes Levi, Mikach Pas Levi, right? I'm told that the birth of Yitzchak is sort of predicted, yeah? Right? Shimshon's birth is predicted. The angel comes to his mother, Zilpah pregnant, right? What do all four of these births seem to have in common? Yitzchak's birth, Shmuel's birth, I guess
Baron,
I have to know.
Barren women.
Yeah, barren women, or in the case of Yocheved, there's always some kind of tension. Yeah, that there's their, who wants to bring more children into this terrible world. I once saw a perush, the name Aharon means, Herayon, I'm pregnant. Oh, I'm going to give birth to a baby to be another slave. After what do you think Miriam means? It means bitterness. Right? To have a child at such a time, right, which fits into the Maamar Chazal, the Sechasota, that they separated from her because they want to have more children. Right? So that just puts Shmuel into this company of of extraordinary stories, and his mother is barren as well. It happens to be the Haftorah of first day of Rosh Hashanah. How does this fit into Rosh Hashanah? You have an idea?
Well, it's on a frame question.
Okay, it parallels Sarah's, the story of Sarah giving birth in the Haftorah reading. Hashem Pakad Sarah Kasher Amar. Right? So I'll tell you the, I want to introduce you to, as we go along, I'll introduce you, maybe have a special page for this. There's a sefer called, it's called Chazon HaMikra. Chazon HaMikra by Yisachar Yaakovson. It's a book on the Haftorahs of the year, including all the Yom Tovim, every time you ever say Haftorah. And he basically does three things on every Haftorah. He tells you what the Haftorah is about, how it's connected to the parasha we just finished, right? And every parasha, this is the great thing, the best thing of the book, is that at the end of doing this, he has some kind of harchava, some kind of elaboration on the theme of the Haftorah. And his elaboration of this Haftorah is motherhood in the Bible. Motherhood in the Bible. What connects motherhood to Rosh Hashanah? I know mother is giving birth, the Hayom Haras Olam. Go beyond that. What connects motherhood to Rosh Hashanah? And then when you contemplate that the second day of Rosh Hashanah is the Akedah and Yiryahu, it's Yiryahu Perek Lamed Aleph, that says, Rochel Mevako al Boneho, Me'anoli Nochem al Boneho Ki Einenu. And think, what is the main function, the main observance of Rosh Hashanah? Is to blow a shofar that the Gemara in the second Rosh Hashanah says is supposed to sound like a woman crying. But see, Abev Aim Sisra. Trua is Targum to Trua is Yevava. And the Yevava is only, the word appears only once in the Tanakh. But see, Abev Aim Sisra. You know, she was a Russia, her son is a Russia, but a mother crying is still a mother crying. So the shofar is supposed to sound like a mother crying for a child. Motherhood is an essential theme of Rosh Hashanah. Zeh Kadosh Baruch Hu, who has more mercies than a mother? Right? The answer is, only you. There's beautiful Rashi in the Haftorah of the second day of Rosh Hashanah that talks about Rachel. I'm sure you're familiar with the pasuk, right? Rachel's crying for her sons. So Rashi asks, why Rachel more than Rivka? Why Rachel more than Abigail? What makes Rachel so special, right? So one level, yes, you're going to say because
she wasn't married first. She had to wait all this time.
Okay.
She meant because for all.
Okay, that's actually the answer that Rashi ends up giving. But so some say that because she's buried along the journey from Yerushalayim up to Bavel, right? I hate to tell you this, but I'm going to say Shmuel is the Sefer that Kever Rachel is mentioned in Sefer Shmuel. Right? We're going to get up to it later in the third week or so. But we're going to have something to say about that. But hold on for a moment. Rashi says, and it's a story that's going to take a little while. Rashi says that when Hashem wanted to destroy Bnei Israel at the time of Churban Beis HaMikdash, the first Churban, that Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Leah, and Rachel all came to give their arguments why Hashem shouldn't do it. And Avram said, "Look, God, I was ready to give you my son for you. You can't have mercy for Bnei Israel." So Hashem gave each one of them why their argument wasn't good enough. So Rachel opened her heart. She spoke last. And Rachel says, "Tell me, God, why do you want to destroy them?" He says, "Well, you know, all these years they've been worshipping Avodah Zarah. But I'm willing to forgive that. But you know what Menashe did? Menashe brought the Avodah Zarah into the Beis HaMikdash. That's too far. If a woman wants to commit adultery and she goes to the man's house or she goes to a hotel, that's one thing. But to bring the man into my bedroom? that's adultery is adultery, right? But to bring the Avodah Zarah into the Beis HaMikdash itself, into the Kodesh Kedoshim, impossible. Right? I can't forgive that. So Yerachah says, God, whose mercies are greater, yours or man's? Who has more mercy, you or man? There's not the most merciful man is not as merciful as I am. So Rachel says, okay, then let me tell you why you should forgive her. Because I took another woman into my house. Yaakov worked for me, right? I knew that my father was coming up with some kind of... I didn't even show up at the wedding. All I had to do was show up at the wedding, and Yaakov would know that it's not me under the chuppah, right? I knew what my father was doing, and I even gave my sister those signs. Right? This is interesting, right? She says, right? So Hashem tells her, what's your point? Well, I was ready to take a tsara. A tsara is the terminology for a co-spouse. In this case, a co-wife. So I took a tsara into my home. So you should forgive them for bringing a tsara into your home. You get it? The tsara of Varbayon tsara, Pasuk in Zechariah, Chazal Darshan, the tsara is like a tsara. Tsara is a co-wife. We'll see right here. The word is used right here at the beginning of Pnim and Chana, sorrows to each other. Right? They're competing for the love of the same man. So Rachel says, if I took the tzara into my house, I don't condone the behavior of Bnei Israel, but you should at least forgive Bnei Israel for taking the tzara into their house. And Hashem says, I'm forgiving them because you did that so long ago. Right? Amazing. There are other drashas about what Rachel's act means to us historically, but that is why we read about Rachel and Rosh Hashanah. So we have all this that's Yisachar Yaakovson's elaboration of Rosh Hashanah, motherhood in the Bible. What's its connection to Rosh Hashanah? I just made right the mercy. We want you to have the mercy of a mother. Okay, got it. All right. So here there are two women competing for Elkanah's love. One has lots of children, one has no children. It's sort of like a Leah and Rachel situation again, right? You hear it? So, Chazal say that Penina had 10 children. Okay, and they went to Shiloh to observe the festival. Well, Lila Regal, that was Yerushalayim was Shiloh. Yerushalayim was not a Jewish, it's not an Israelite city at that time. The Yebusi stayed in Yerushalayim until David conquered it. Okay, and it tells you right away that Eli was the Kohen Gadol, but his sons were not behaving properly. Just says that they were. That Eli was the Kohen Gadol. He put two sons in charge, Hophni and Pinchas. you ever hear that? What's the busiest time for therapists? It's around the holiday. Because people who are naturally depressed become even more depressed at the time when they feel they're supposed to be happy. Right? So it's a holiday, whether you do it holiday, you give out gifts, right? So you see the people behaving in an insensitive manner. Her husband, Elkanah, is handing out gifts to Penina and all her children, and he gives a double gift to Hannah, twice as much as he gives to Penina. Hannah's interested in the gifts. She's interested in children. Right? Can't you be magnanimous for the sake of your co-wife? Your husband loves you more, it says in the text that he... But, okay. But she's still very depressed about her... You know, at that time in history, you know, we see the way Rachel talks to Yaakov. Hobbly bunny, you know, I ain't Mesa ani. Give me sons already, or I'll die. Right? And it says in Pasuk Vav that Penina even angered Hannah more. Chiyasata. She angered her. Rashi says it was a Shem Shemayim. Listen, Hannah, stop fetching. Do something. Go ahead and pray it to yourself. But stop sticking around here. Right? And this is what would go on every year, year after year, or regel after regel. And then one particular time, Elkanah sees that she's crying, she refuses to eat, she refuses to drink. Right? And this is just the pasuk I wanted to concentrate on, which is why won't you eat? Why won't you drink? Why are you so upset? Yiralababech means why are you depressed? Halo anochi tov lach me'asara banim. What do you think he means by that? Am I not better for you than 10 sons? Tell me, let's say two things that can mean.
Meaning, do I not like I guess that satisfy your needs?
Good, that's one. Most of the Mephoshim say that. Is that, look, what does a woman want? Women always outlived men by a lot. A, they would marry men much older, 10 or 15 years older. And B, men throughout history died on average 10 to 15 years before women. Let's say 10 years. Now it's about 7 years in America. All right? So you're talking about a woman living 20, 25 years alone. You get my point? So who's going to look after me at that time? If I don't have children. Children, of course. My children will look after me. My grandchildren might look after me. Right? If I never have any children, my husband predeceases me by 20, 25 years, who's going to look after me? So what does he tell her? I'll set you up as if though you had 10 children looking after you. That's the first picture. What else? So I couldn't love you more than even if you gave me 10 children. Even if you recognize my 10 children, I wouldn't love you any more. That's how much I love you. I do good, you know, you think I do good things for Penina because she keeps giving me children. I do more than that for you. Okay. By the way, he doesn't get it. And it's only now that nothing Penina did made her pray, but this statement makes her pray. Because what does it look like to Chana, this statement? He's given up, yeah, he's given up on her. Yeah. I don't know how old Chana is here, but she has 5 kids after Shmuel. Shmuel's about to be born, and she has 5 kids after that. She might be, you know.
Who has 5 kids?
She's 5, after she gives birth to Shmuel at the end of the story,
really?
Says she gives birth to five more kids afterwards. 3 boys and 2 girls. So we'll close with this, is that this seems to be him giving up on her. Okay, and then she prays, and Eli gives her the blessing that she should have a child. When that child is born, he's very successful, and the text will contrast him with Eli's own sons, and that's where we'll start next class. Make sure to bring a Shmuel, right? I will have the full syllabus for you.